Today on Against the Grain, gene-guided healthcare has taken U.S. medicine by storm, promising precision, targeted treatments to myriad illnesses. It has also proved very profitable. James Tabry traces how genetic medicine vied within the federal government with another approach to healthcare, one emphasizing the social and environmental determinants of health, such as whether you live in a polluted neighborhood, and triumphed over it. He argues that private industry has benefited while public health has suffered. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The mapping of the human genome was greeted with great fanfare and helped usher in a new era of medical treatments based on DNA tailoring. Are we better off for it? Or has the rise of medicine based on our individual genome, which has supplanted funding for an approach to our well-being based on the environments in which we live, left us in worse shape, as James Tabry argues? Tabry is professor of philosophy at the University of Utah and the author of Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Let me begin by asking you, Jim, if you could give us a sense of what we mean when we say personalized or precision medicine and what its promises according to its proponents.
Sure. You know, when personalized medicine was first introduced as a kind of marketing slogan in the late 1990s, it was really meant to capture this idea that in order to get proper health care, that has to be guided in a very real way by your genetics, by your DNA, by your genome. And 20, 25 years later, that's still the case. When you hear people talk about personalized medicine, or sometimes they'll say precision medicine, 95% of the time what they're talking about is getting DNA and then either deciding what drug you should get based on that DNA or perhaps what diagnostic test you should get based on your DNA. That's what we're talking about there. The promise are great if you listen to the advocates. You'll often hear talk of miracle cures coming along or biomedical breakthroughs, game-changing drugs. And so typically what's happening is the champions of this approach are pointing to genuine innovations that have come about in the last quarter century. And then this supposition is we're going to see these across healthcare. It's not just going to be in cancer. It's going to be in psychiatry and treating diabetes or cardiovascular disease. The thought is also that it will drive down the costs of healthcare rather than sort of sending people off on trial and error odysseys where we don't know what treatment's going to work best for patients. The thought is if we are basing your healthcare on your genomic information, that's going to work right off the bat. And so that's another promise. And then the last promise I'll just mention is there's a lot of excitement about battling unjust racial health inequities. So the United States in particular, it just has an abhorrent history of racial health disparities, which continue to impact communities of color. And champions of personalized or precision medicine will say that, look, if we can get, you know, communities of color involved in the research, that will ensure that these miracle cures and breakthrough treatments and cost savings are going to extend to everyone and then thereby combat those unjust inequities.
Well, we'll talk in much greater detail about all these different facets, but just as a way of situating us as we go into this discussion, I wonder if you could tell us how significant are genetic differences between us. How significant are they in their responsibility for the major illnesses that most people face?
For the vast majority of conditions that the vast majority of people face, the answer is they make a very, very small contribution. And so, you know, what we're talking about here are, you know, think about the health conditions, the diseases, the illnesses that take the largest toll on most people. Diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, right? So we're thinking about things like heart attacks and strokes, most cancers, respiratory illnesses, mental health issues. When you think about those things, right, the kind of the health conditions that are impacting folks today, we've got decades of genetic research now that shows that individual genes and known genetic contributions are quite small to those traits. And so it's really when we shift from those very common diseases to rarer conditions where you start to see genetics get some purchase. And I would say some of the confusion surrounding personalized medicine occurs when people will look at those innovations that occur when it comes to rare diseases and then just assume that we're going to see that translate to things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
Well, Ben, given that, and taking into account those rare diseases, can we generalize about the effectiveness of genetically based medicine in practice, putting celebration or hype aside?
No, I don't think we can expect that to happen. And in fact, there's all sorts of limitations even when we're just talking about rare diseases. So, you know, I think maybe just to be a little more practical, when we're talking about rare diseases, we're thinking about things like cystic fibrosis, sickle cell, spinal muscular atrophy, beta thalassemia. These are all sorts of conditions, whether they're neurological or blood-based, that affect a fairly small number of people, a small number of typically children born every year. And what makes those rather unique is for a very long time, we've known them to be caused by specific genes. The challenge in the past was sort of taking that basic genetic information and then translating it into interventions that could be used to combat those illnesses. And it turns out for some of those conditions, interventions have been developed. It turns out those interventions, for all sorts of reasons, are extremely expensive. But setting that economic issue aside for the moment, they have shown to be effective treatments for some of these rare diseases. The problem then is when you switch to something like diabetes or Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's or, you know, lung cancer, there's no just clear genetic cause. And as a result, there's no obvious place to make that clean biomedical intervention where some sort of pharmaceutical therapy is going to take somebody who might have had something and then not have it because they're not caused by their genes. They're by and large caused by the environments that they're exposed to.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago the very substantial costs of personalized medical treatments. And yet also part of the promise, right, is that by targeting particular genes and making drugs available to particular people rather than others for which maybe they wouldn't work, then you cut out various inefficiencies and costs in the medical system. Have we seen personalized medicine cutting costs for our, you know, already enormously expensive and, of course, privatized system of healthcare?
I think the short answer is it remains to be seen. There are no sort of clear examples where costs have come rushing down as a result of one of these personalized medicine interventions, in part because a lot of this stuff is quite new. But the early signs are worrisome. So let me give you an example. Spinal muscular atrophy, neural condition that affects children that have a faulty version of a particular gene that allows for normal neural growth. But when they have this faulty version of it, their neurons don't develop in the same way. And you know, for very long time, if a child was born with spinal muscular atrophy, depending on the particular form that they had, it could be a death sentence. That, you know, you basically have children who would be born and by all appearances initially seem fine, but then developmental progress doesn't occur and basically their neurological system slowly breaks down and they can't live. And so they're just absolutely tragic cases for the families, for the children, for the parents. Many, many resources have gone into trying to sustain life and make life better for children who are born with spinal muscular atrophy. Spinal muscular atrophy is a known genetic condition, and so it's a natural case then for researchers to try to target some sort of personalized medicine intervention. And fortunately, those have been developed. The famous example is a drug called Zolgensma. And essentially what that drug tries to do is help these kids who have this faulty version of that gene receive the essentially molecular resources to offset that inadequacy. Zolgensma was priced at millions of dollars. And that's in large part because there's just not a lot of people out there with spinal muscular atrophy. And so the companies that develop the drugs want to recoup their research and development costs. And so they price these things extremely high. Now, part of the rationale for pricing them extremely high was the claim of, well, look, we're going to get at the genetic cause. So rather than investing lots and lots of medical resources trying to treat the symptoms of spinal muscular atrophy for these children, Zolgensma is going to solve that problem. It's going to make that go away. And then all those costs that would have been there aren't going to be there because they're going to be cured. We just are starting to get data now on children who have been treated with Zolgensma, and what their physicians are finding is even when they get this multi-million dollar treatment, in many cases the doctors have to supplement it with many of the treatments that they were giving their kids who weren't getting Zolgensma because it wasn't the cure that it was made out to be. And so you've got this just, you know, exorbitantly priced drug that led people to think this is going to make all those other problems go away. And what we found is that's not the case.
I'm speaking with James Tabry. He's professor of philosophy and the author of Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were speaking about the costs, you know, enormous for many people. I wanted to ask you, beyond cost, what are the tangible consequences of personalized medicine for the patients themselves? You actually, your family experienced some of this when your father was diagnosed with cancer.
That's right. The way I first encountered personalized medicine was when my father was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. This was back in 2011. And I wasn't tuned into this topic as a research project at that time. I was working on a different book. And so I didn't fully kind of appreciate what was unfolding until several years later. But what I did see stuck with me. And so when I became interested in personalized medicine around 2015, I realized that watching my dad's experience was really illustrative of what people, you know, all over the world are experiencing. And so what I saw was my father was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Lung cancer is the most common cancer in the United States. It is often not caught until it is metastatic, which is what makes it particularly deadly, because oftentimes doctors just don't pick it up until after it's spread to the brain, to the liver, to the bones. And that was the case with my dad. By the time he was diagnosed, he was actually paralyzed from the waist down because the cancer had spread to his spinal cord and cut off his spinal cord and the ability to relay, you know, neural messages to his legs. It was a shock for our family. And when we saw the nature of the problem and began looking into, you know, sort of what is the prognosis given being diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, it was really terrifying. At that time in 2011, the sort of survival expectancy was about 8 months if you're diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And, you know, my dad was recently retired. My mom and my dad were about to go on a cruise to Canada. You know, they sort of saw their retirement years unfolding ahead of them, and suddenly this was this just horrific curveball that came out of nowhere. But it turned out that after doctors had done a biopsy of his tumors, they realized that he was a good match for this drug called Tarceva. And Tarceva was one of the early sort of success stories in personalized medicine. What they found was it didn't work for everybody who had lung cancer, but it worked for a certain subset of patients with lung cancer who had a particular molecular marker on the surface of the cancerous cells. And my dad had that molecular marker, and so he was a good candidate for Tarceva. And they put him on the drug, and sure enough, the tumors began shrinking, and it created some real joy in our family. You know, it ultimately does not have a happy ending, but there's definitely a sense in which access to that drug allowed my father to live longer, and that's something that our family is incredibly grateful for.
So you've been describing the complexity of personalized genetically based medicine, the fact that as you stated at the outset, so much of illness or the kind of illnesses most of us are going to encounter are not going to be genetically determined. So given all of that, who stands to benefit from this approach, which you argue has seen a major shift in the orientation of medicine in the United States?
Yeah, well, certainly biotech companies stand to benefit from this, right? And so we'd be talking about companies in particular that do the genetic diagnostic work. So if there's a particular test that's being developed to determine whether a particular patient, is a match for some particular drug, those companies are just expanding rapidly. Similarly, there are biotech giants like the company Illumina, which sort of creates the machines that actually do the genetic testing. They are benefiting greatly from this. And then you also have pharmaceutical companies that are, sort of shifting their research and development resources towards personalized medicines. And because these things are just so high priced, they tend to benefit as well. And so, by and large, what we're talking about is private industry here, and the private industries that are focused on genetic testing, diagnostics, drug development have really supported this shift. And one example of this is oftentimes they're involved in personalized medicine initiatives where you might not even initially expect to see them. So, give you an example, there's lots of hospital systems across the country now that are enrolling patients into personalized medicine initiatives. And essentially what they're telling their patients are, give us your DNA, we'll use that for research, we'll then be able to help combat the kind of health conditions that are affecting you, your family, and your community. And you can benefit too, because then we'll be able to test to see if you're at risk of various cancers and heart diseases. And it turns out that almost across the board, wherever you see one of these large personalized medicine initiatives being sponsored or rolled out by a hospital system, there is a pharmaceutical company or a biotech company partnering who basically work with the hospital. They get the genetic data. They then do the genetic testing and provide it back to the hospital. The hospital can then use that. And the research that is being done in coordination with the hospital and the private company. And then if any developments are made, the hospital system and the pharmaceutical company or the biotech company benefit from that. And so that's one of these cases where you sort of, you might think if your doctor is asking you to sign up for a massive genetic study, this is just about something between you and your doctor or you and your doctor in the hospital. But it turns out you've got these private industry players also there because they want access to that genetic data because of all the possibilities that it creates for private industry.
Not to take us too far afield, but does this represent a shift in the orientation of, say, pharmaceuticals companies? At one point, the push was to try and across the board get the public to take drugs in large number, like, for example, statins or hormone replacement therapy. Whereas this is, instead of a kind of broad approach, making a whole lot of money by having a large, large swath of the population prescribe drugs, that this is very narrow sections of the public, but at a very high price.
That's right. And I don't think that takes us too far afield. That strikes me as, in some sense, sort of one of the real cruxes of the issue here. As you said, when you think about the drug giants of today, the Pfizers, the Glaxos, many of these major corporations really hit their stride in the mid to late 20th century. And this is sometimes called the blockbuster era of the pharmaceutical industry, or the golden age of the pharmaceutical industry. And the way these massive pharmaceutical giants became what they are is, as you said, they developed pharmaceutical interventions that were designed to be the kind of go-to treatment for something that lots and lots of people had. So, you know, maybe it's acid reflux, and then Prilosec's going to be the thing that where you, the, you know, the company thought is everybody who gets acid reflux is going to take Prilosec, or allergies, and then Claritin, the hope is going to be everybody who has allergies is going to take Claritin. And you can just sort of go down the list there, whether it's heart conditions or diabetes, or, you know, we talked about allergies or acid reflux. The way you sort of became a way you got a blockbuster drug was it was the thing that everybody got prescribed who had that thing. And that's very different from the personalized medicine approach, right? The personalized medicine approach is the thought that, you know what, your acid reflux might be different from my acid reflux because our genetics are different. Or my allergy, my ability to take some particular allergy drug is going to be different from your ability to take particular allergy drug because the way your body metabolizes drugs, Sasha, is different from mine, and that's based on the genetic differences between us. And so that personalized medicine is really this shift towards carving patient populations who we traditionally thought of as one thing, like everybody with acid reflux or everybody with a diabetes or everybody with allergies, into these smaller populations based on their molecular genetic profiles. And so, you know, what I would say is to the extent that we see more and more of healthcare revolving around the idea that the way you address and fix health problems is drug them, there's going to be more and more of a shift to this personalized medicine approach because the manufacturers of those drugs are headed in that direction.
Take us back to the late 1950s when Rachel Carson started work on her groundbreaking book, Silent Spring, about the effects of DDT on birds and other living creatures. That period was in some ways a pivotal one because it was also the time that a pioneering geneticist, Arnold Matulski, made his innovations. Can you describe that moment and tell us about these two figures, Rachel Carson and Arnold Matulski?
Yeah, you bet. You know, the book, Tyranny of the Gene, it's not just about expressing worries and flagging problems associated with personalized medicine. It's drawing attention to the fact that there is this other revolution that has been unfolding parallel to the genomic revolution. And in fact, if what we want to do are cut the costs of healthcare, help marginalized communities, and make populations healthier, that in fact, it's this other revolution that we should be spending more time focused on and investing more resources in. And so what you're drawing attention to is chapter one in the book, where I try to show that these two revolutions were, in fact, born in a way the same year, and that year was 1957. So everything that we've been talking about so far regarding personalized medicine, you can really trace back to this guy, Arnold Matulski. He was a medical geneticist at the University of Washington at the time. And what he proposed was essentially geneticists teaming up with pharmacologists to understand how and why different people metabolize drugs differently. And that set the stage for what became was first called pharmacogenetics, and then now it's called pharmacogenomics. But really, pharmacogenomics was what personalized medicine was. The person who coined the phrase personalized medicine was really just marketing pharmacogenomics, but they didn't think people would know what pharmacogenomics was, so they decided to call it personalized medicine, and then sort of were off and running. So you can see that sort of clear line from Arnold Matulski's idea of geneticists and pharmacologists teaming up to we get pharmacogenetics and then pharmacogenomics and then personalized medicine, and bam, we're in the present, the genomic revolution that's supposed to be happening in healthcare. That same year, go back to 1957, that Matulski is proposing this union of genetics and pharmacology, a woman in Massachusetts finds dead songbirds all over her property following a state-sponsored program of spraying DDT. And DDT in the middle of the 20th century was just thought to be this, you know, sort of example of humans triumphing over nature. It was an insecticide that was going to eradicate all sorts of vermin and last long periods of time and, you know, basically allow for increases in crop yield and decreases in things like malaria. But what Olga Owens Huckins found when she sort of walked out onto her property in a summer morning in 1957 was that it sort of had killed birds all over the place, and it had killed bees, and it had killed grasshoppers. And she even says, sort of ironically, the one thing it didn't seem to kill were the mosquitoes that it was designed to kill. And she writes to her friend and says, hey, can you help me do something about this, because the state's just going gangbusters with spraying DDT, and it looks like it's really dangerous. And that friend, as you mentioned, was Rachel Carson. And at the time, Rachel Carson was already sort of tracking DDT and interested in it. And what becomes the result of that research is Silent Spring. And, you know, that's the book that we now think of as sort of galvanizing the American environmental movement. I think when people sort of reflect on Carson's legacy, oftentimes what they associate her with the American environmental movement are, you know, things like saving estuaries or saving the bald eagle, or, you know, it's focused on animals and environments out there in the world. But what Carson also drew attention to was, you know, things like DDT, these toxins in the environment, don't just affect bald eagle chicks. They also affect humans. And what sort of also comes out of that American environmental movement is this really kind of a public health revolution, where biomedical researchers are interested in how are the things that we are doing to the environment in turn coming back and impacting our own health. And it, you know, becomes a really revolutionary idea, where now it's not just about humans triumphing over nature. It's a question of how are the things that we're doing when we're trying to triumph over nature in turn negatively impacting our health.
I'm speaking with James Tabry about his book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. That's published by Knopf. We're discussing the advent of medicine that's supposed to be tailored to our individual genome and the forces that have backed such an approach and its history. James Tabry teaches philosophy at the University of Utah, where he's a member of the Center for Health, Ethics, Arts, and Humanities. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So although private industry plays an outsized role in U.S. healthcare and medicine, obviously, the federal government remains central and was central through the 20th century in determining where public funding would be allocated. I wonder if you could talk about the federal government's support for the two approaches to thinking about health and illness that were represented in the late 50s by the work of Rachel Carson, emphasizing the environmental factors that shape our health and propensity to illness, and the genetically oriented and a pharmaceutically oriented approach of Arno Matulski. How should we see those two trajectories, one emphasizing the environment, the other emphasizing genes, when we look at the orientation of the U.S. government in the mid to later 20th century?
So, you know, the narrative that runs really through the book, Tyranny of the Gene, traces this competition that unfolded at the U.S. National Institutes of Health to create a nationwide study of health in America. So if we rewind to sort of the turn of the millennium, we go back to 2000, there were a number of other countries across the world that had already set up successful large longitudinal cohorts. And so what we're talking about here are sort of federally organized efforts to recruit tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million people, track their health over time, with the vision being to then understand what are the causes of health and illness in our particular nation. And there was a real interest at the National Institutes of Health starting around 2000 to 2003 to get something like that up and running in the United States. One of those initiatives was what became called the National Children's Study. It was called for in the Children's Health Act of 2000 by Congress, and it was very much inspired by Rachel Carson, pediatric health research, and that environmental understanding of health and illness. You know, pediatricians know better than just about anybody the impact of environment on health, because they deal with kids. And kids, as you know, anybody who's spent time around kids know, are little sponges. They're putting things in their mouth. They're absorbing conversations around them. Their skin is thinner than ours, and so they're also absorbing things through their skin. They're breathing in things. They are much more susceptible to environmental exposures than adults are. And so this National Children's Study was designed to recruit 100,000 children from across the United States and follow them from, in some cases, before birth, all the way until they were adults, and then just collecting massive amounts of information about their environment. So what's going on in their home, what's going on in the area outside their home, what's going on in their neighborhood, what's going on in their schools. So that at the end of all this, you'd have this enormous set of information about sort of what they've been exposed to. And then in turn, you could look and see, you know, who's developing schizophrenia, who's developing autism, who's developing diabetes, who's developing heart disease. And then the hope was, right, you'd be able to sort of understand then and provide interventions for decreasing the likelihood that these conditions later in life or even in childhood emerge when you figure out where they came from. That's one thing that was getting up and running at the National Institutes of Health. The other effort was much more explicitly about genetics. This went by different names over the years. What it became is what's currently called the All of Us Research Program. But the vision on that project was to have a massive nationwide study of largely adults, where you would get genetic information from them. You'd also gather some, you know, sort of basic biological, physical stuff, you know, sort of how tall you are, how much you weigh. You might ask a couple surveys to sort of ask them about sort of their behaviors and habits. And then you would just get access to their, basically their medical records. And what you're looking for are there associations between genetic differences between the people in those research projects or that research project and different health outcomes, right? So the people that are developing diabetes more likely to have one particular gene than people who don't get diabetes. Other people who are having really serious strokes more likely to have one particular genetic profile than people who aren't having very serious strokes. And essentially, these two efforts to kind of launch a nationwide study lived in parallel and in many cases lived in competition for about a decade at the National Institutes of Health. And what I try to do in the book is show how we can, in some sense, understand how this competition that was playing out in one federal agency really provides a lens for understanding how something that's happening across the country in healthcare and across the country in biomedical research and why it is that the federal government and hospitals and researchers and pharmaceutical and private industry are leaning more and more towards that genetic approach and away from that environmental approach.
Well, tell us what happened with these two orientations within the National Institute of Health, within the level of federal healthcare orientation. How did their trajectories start to diverge through the administrations of George W. Bush and then Barack Obama?
Let me tell you the punchline and then we'll sort of work up to it. So the punchline is, today, you cannot enroll or enroll your children in the National Children's Study. However, you could go online, enroll in the genetically oriented All of Us Research Program. The All of Us Research Program sort of first was announced in its kind of earlier name, but in its current form, in President Barack Obama's 2015 State of the Union Address. So that was in January 2015. In December of 2014, the National Institutes of Health terminated the National Children's Study. So within a month of each other, one gets shut down permanently, the other one is finally brought to life. The official version of events is that the National Children's Study was mismanaged, that it was too ambitious, that the original leadership of it lied to leadership at the National Institutes of Health and even at Congress. And so there's this sense of kind of that thing was destined to fail, whereas the All of Us Research Program learned from those mistakes and it's not going to repeat them. And that's why it's going to be a successful enterprise where the other one was a failure. What the book shows is the relationship between these two endeavors was far more complicated than that kind of pat story. If we rewind all the way to 2003, there was actually an effort by the leaders of both of these Project. So at that time, it would have been Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project and the head of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the NIH, who wanted to launch the genomics initiative. And then over at the Child Health Initiative, again, another institute at the NIH, was Dwayne Alexander. And so you basically have these two directors of institutes at the National Institutes of Health who are both interested in launching a nationwide study. And the earliest formulation, it was quite innovative, and it's sort of interesting to wonder what could have happened if this played out differently. Initially, they tried working together to see if they could sort of combine the interest in adults and genetics with kids and environments to make one nationwide study where this stuff can happen in an integrated fashion. But it just becomes clear that that's not going to work, that Collins' interest in focusing on genetics and Alexander's interest in focusing on environment, they were just trying to achieve different things. And so they didn't think that they could sort of work together. And so within a fairly short period of time, they go their separate ways. They could have stayed at those separate paths because as I've described, they were quite different in design and goals and purpose. But Collins ends up taking a fairly combative stance towards the National Children's Study and shifts towards explaining to those who will listen why the thing that he's trying to design is better than the National Children's Study. And what ends up happening is he's able to harness resources from private industry, political support, media narratives, biotech advances that Dwayne Alexander is just not able to harness. And so what happens is as time goes on, Collins' genetic approach gains more and more momentum. That's finally realized when President Obama comes along, who's always been a real fan of genomic initiatives. And the National Children's Study stutters, trips, loses its footing, and ultimately fails. And so what I try to do in the book is show how, those things that Dr. Collins is able to draw upon to make the case for this nationwide study of genetics that he wants to launch are really those same forces that are driving this personalized medicine revolution across healthcare. It's the private industry interest. It's the support from politicians across the political spectrum. It's the biotech advances. It's the media fascination with stories about cures. Those played out in the dynamic in the federal agency of the National Institutes of Health, but they aren't confined there. They're literally forces that are affecting all of us today.
So, the Human Genome Project was completed in 2003. The National Children's Study, as you mentioned, was killed in 2014. Around all of this, especially the Human Genome Project, is this sort of sense of scientific inevitability, right? That there's sort of a drive into the future, that this is the place of future revelation and research and innovation and promise, and that in some sense there's a kind of inevitability in the way that on some level a kind of tale of different institutions plays out. But it seems like what you're saying here is that we should be wary of that notion that, although obviously technical innovation did play a role in allowing for the mapping of the human genome and so on, that in many ways political choices and social factors in terms of private interests were really at the heart of how this story ended up, not science itself, if there's such a thing as pure science.
No, I think that's right. I think there's a parallel here. You were speaking with an author of The Innovation Delusion, and I think the dynamic's similar there, where there's this thought that more innovation, faster, cheaper, quicker, more opportunities for profit is always going to be better than something that takes longer or something that doesn't create that opportunity for profit or something that requires more time to collect. And so when you look at, I don't think you need to call it pure science, but if you're just sort of thinking like, let's take a historical approach. Let's look at the last century of scientific and medical advances and take stock of what is making us healthier at the population level. And those things are, by and large, making the environments in which we live safer. It's you know, things like clean water, clean air, getting lead out of gasolines, getting lead out of paint, minimizing exposure to all sorts of insecticides, herbicides, pesticides. And there's countless things, I think the assumption is, even today that we're being exposed to that we might not even fully appreciate the kind of threats that they're creating for our health. In contrast, you know, the increase in population level health for very expensive drugs that work for fairly few people has been fairly minimal. It does, they can provide life-saving treatments for small numbers of people, and I don't think we want to, you know, we certainly shouldn't minimize that, but they're not having huge impacts on those health conditions that are affecting the most people. So that's, I think, the background that we want to sort of just understand and not take for granted. And yet, what I try to describe is that we're in the midst of what I call a genetic swerve in healthcare. There's this pivot that's taking place in the federal government in terms of how we're focusing our biomedical research resources, in pharmaceutical companies in terms of where they're placing their R&D resources, at hospital systems when they're creating new research enterprises, that is focusing on getting DNA from patients and using genetic data to guide the future of innovations. And what I, you know, claim is that's not because getting that genetic information, we should expect to have a huge impact on health outcomes. Rather, we're going all in on this genetic swerve because it's just become very easy to get that genetic data. It's cheap to get that genetic data. You can get that genetic data very quickly. There is plenty of opportunities for making lots of money off of getting that genetic data. Magazines and newspapers love stories about getting genetic data and then saving lives. And the reality is when you shift from that genetic side of the coin to the environmental side, it isn't so easy. It's just harder to get environmental information about us. It doesn't lend itself to being processed quickly and in one time. There is less opportunities for making lots of money off of getting that environmental information. Often what we're talking about are prevention stories, not saved lives. And so it's harder to kind of tell those stories in ways that seem really, really engaging. And so that's the dynamic. That's the way I would characterize the dynamic that you were describing. It's, we've got all this information that suggests, right, investing more in the environment is what's going to improve health outcomes and bring down the cost of healthcare and be most beneficial to marginalized communities, and yet we're going all in on this other side because it's just faster, cheaper, easier, more opportunity to make money.
And yet, James Tabry, there's a framing that this orientation toward gene-based medicine is there to address the enormous disparities of health and life expectancy in the U.S., you know, which we know exist and are deeply rooted based on class and based on race. And you mentioned the launching in 2018 of the All of Us research program, which promises personalized medicine for those who are historically excluded. So it's gathering massive amounts of data from people, asking people of color to make available their data, their genetic data, as a means of rectifying racial health disparities. You've sort of been tracing it as we've been going, but I wonder specifically as it bears on race and ethnicity, why should we be skeptical of that kind of approach for rectifying these enormous disparities that exist?
Yeah, and I highlight in particular the All of Us research program just because it is so historic and the federal investment in it is so large, and because the claim that it was going to battle racial health disparities was just so overt. So when you looked at the early marketing efforts by the program to recruit participants, there was a very high priority set on creating a very diverse cohort. And the outreach efforts were placed in, you know, Harlem in New York City and the Hills District in Pittsburgh. They were targeting communities of color. And the advertising said, you know, it was, you know, sign up and prevent health disparities, right? So it was just so explicit. And that's one of the reasons that I focus on that particular project. But we should say, this is something that's happening across genetics. If you go to genetic conferences, read genetic journals, look at genetic newsletters, just talk to geneticists, there is a real priority now on having that research combat racial health disparities. You know, and I think the first thing to say here is just, these are very well-intentioned efforts. These are well-intentioned people. The goal to combat racial health disparities, I think, is a good one. To the extent that there are scientists out there trying to achieve that end, I applaud that. What's particularly challenging in this case, though, is I talked earlier about how we've got all this history of biomedical research that shows investing in the environment is better for improving health outcomes for populations than going all in on our genetics. We've also got decades of research that shows that's particularly true for marginalized communities and communities of color. When we shift from talking about, say, diabetes to health disparities in diabetes, or when we shift from talking about cardiovascular disease to why do Black communities have higher rates of cardiovascular disease than white communities, or why do Latino populations have higher rates of diabetes than other populations, right? Those disparities now, it's very clear, are the result of different environmental exposures of these different groups. Marginalized communities are just placed in environments where the air is less safe to breathe, the water is less safe to drink, there is higher levels of noise pollution, the neighborhoods tend to be less walkable, they tend to be harder to access fresh fruits and vegetables. And so we've structured our environments in ways that are just less healthy for marginalized communities. What's dangerous then about sort of telling these communities, going to these communities and say, hey, sign up for our research project, we're going to combat those problems, and what you're doing is by and large prioritizing the collection of genetic data, is it's going to distract from the actual causes of those problems, right? If you're saying, hey, help us combat diabetes in your community, and then you collect the data from these communities, and then you go looking for the genetic causes of diabetes disparities, that is not just a wasted effort, it is going to feed a misconception that diabetes in these communities is caused by genes, right? It's something in your body that's the problem. It's not about the environment that you live in. And that's very dangerous because, you know, to the extent that we do genuinely want to combat these problems, we need to get at them at their source.
And as you point out in the book, even with illnesses that we do know where the gene is identified as the culprit in the disease, it doesn't necessarily mean that that will lead to appropriate funding and therefore treatment. Can you tell us about the very different funding of for sickle cell anemia, which predominantly affects African Americans, and cystic fibrosis, which predominantly affects those of European descent?
Yeah, so it's interesting to place sickle cell disease and cystic fibrosis side by side because in some ways quite similar, and in other ways they're quite different. So ways that they're similar, fairly similar genetic mechanism. They're both the results of autosomal recessive traits. You basically need to get one faulty copy from each of your parents, and then that will result in you having the disease. They are both really awful diseases to have. So sickle cell is a blood disorder. It leads to red blood cells forming improperly. Those can create all sorts of blockages, painful crises, damage to nerves, ultimately sort of destroying the body. Cystic fibrosis works similarly, although now it's not blood, it's mucus, essentially sort of mucous membranes are not as slick as they should be. And so things get clogged in your body. And particularly often what's most susceptible are lungs, and also ultimately can sort of lead to lung damage and death. So really awful diseases. Both have been understood for about the same amount of time at the genetic level. Sort of this goes all the way back to the middle of the 20th century. Differences. Far more people are affected both in the United States and across the world by sickle cell than by cystic fibrosis. It's not even close. We're talking sort of hundreds of thousands versus millions upon millions. The other thing, and that's what you just referenced, is sickle cell traditionally impacts people with African ancestry, and cystic fibrosis traditionally typically affects people with European ancestry. It turns out when you look at the history of funding research on these two conditions, there has been far more research dollars per patient focused on cystic fibrosis than on sickle cell. And in turn, what you then find are far more publications related to cystic fibrosis, far more interventions associated with cystic fibrosis, far more comprehensive treatment clinics associated with cystic fibrosis. And so you get this phenomenon where you would think, hey, if we're trying to sort of help the most people, we should be focusing over on this condition. But for all sorts of socioeconomic reasons, it's focused over on the other condition. And I think that's another reason, as you were sort of saying, where, you know, we should be skeptical of this thought that sort of recruiting communities of color into personalized medicine is going to be the route towards combating racial health disparities. Because even if you've got these rare cases where there's a genetic cause of a trait, doing something about that has to take place in the sort of, you know, economic environment that we live in. And that's one where things are tilted against helping communities who are in need.
Well, given that, you know, given the nature of our healthcare system and our society's very deep economic and racial inequality, I realize this is a very unfair question to end with, but what do you think would be necessary to shift U.S. health orientation toward a focus on environmental contributors to ill health, which of course involves a whole lot more cost and really tackling all sorts of social factors, given the way it is oriented now in the society that we live in?
I think there's lots of things that the federal government can do that your listeners can do. So, you know, on the federal government side, investing more of our taxpayer dollars that are devoted to health research on environmental contributions to health and illness, and on interventions that are designed to make the world that we live in a safer space, right? And when we're talking about the environment, we're talking about our physical environment, our social environment, our familial environment, our psychological environment, our work, school environment, using that in a very broad sense. Focusing resources there, it would be a huge step. And we have been out of whack as a federal government for quite some time, going all more and more in on genetics. And so I think we need to sort of reprioritize what focusing on the environment can do. As a society, need to be less enamored by these stories of miracle cures or that are always kind of just over the horizon, right? Sort of, you know, little more investment in genetics and you're going to see all these problems go away. A little more, you know, sort of trust in pharmaceutical companies and we're going to have all these treatments for, you know, you name it. The time-honored way to deal with most health problems is to invest in prevention. And the way you invest in prevention is by making the world that we live in safer. And so I think sort of reminding ourselves of that reality rather than looking for the next big thing, the next innovation, is one way that we can sort of inoculate ourselves from the hype.
James Tabry, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the author of Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. James Tabry teaches philosophy at the University of Utah, where he's a member of the Center for Health Ethics, Arts, and Humanities. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.